This is KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's, as I said, Stephanie Potter with the Recovery Zone, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster, in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by Deacom Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local gardens and nurseries, and seed garlic. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30 at Northeast Deacom and 8th. The entrance is on 8th. DeacomStreetDoorway.com. And here comes the Recovery Zone on KBOO.
Hi. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. And the world is pretty sick right now. Climate change is bearing down on us with record heat waves, droughts and forest fires. The use of fossil fuels, which is driving climate change, is being driven by an economic system that fosters poverty wages along with underemployment, unemployment, and homelessness. Blacks and Hispanics suffer disproportionately from all this. Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, points out that more and more of us actually are being placed in the path of this destruction. We are in a collective crisis, and the solution demands unprecedented cooperation. To heal our world, Rising Tide North America has been calling out for a massive intervention to take place this fall, and it's called Flood the System. And today I have here with me in the studio some representatives from these groups who are affiliated with Portland Rising Tide. And I'd like them, it's actually quite a few of them, it's the biggest crowd I've ever had here in the studio, so I'd like them to go around and just introduce themselves. Starting with you, Mason.
My name is Mason Ashwell. I'm with the PSU Student Union.
Jamie Partridge, I'm with 15 Now, the campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Hi, my name is Alyssa Pagan. I'm with Don't Shoot Portland.
I'm Ibrahim Mubarak with Right to Survive and Right to Dream Too.
I'm Katie Barrett. I'm with Portland Rising Tide.
Mia Reback with 350 PDX.
And there's actually even more people here in the room with us who aren't on microphones because we just don't have that many. So this is the kind of collaboration I think we're talking about. This is a whole lot of people from a lot of different perspectives who are saying that something is wrong and it needs to change. And I'd like to just welcome all of you to this show. And I'd like to start just with the basic concept of what are you trying to accomplish? Like on the Rising Tide website, it talks about root causes. And so the root causes of climate change are apparently very interconnected with a lot of this other stuff. And maybe you could start addressing that, Katie.
Sure. Well, the idea of Flood the System kind of stems from what we see as a bit of a problem in the environmental movement right now, and that's that, you know, it's pretty common for people in the environmental movement to talk about climate change as the big tent issue, as the one issue that affects everybody. And in a way, it's true because it does affect everybody on the planet, but the real big tent here is the system that is driving climate change, that's preventing us from addressing it, and that's also causing all these other problems, like poverty and the prison system and the military-industrial complex, and the list goes on and on. So we're saying, hey, we're all actually fighting the same systems of oppression here, so it's time for us to do some real movement building. And it's a call out for direct action so that we can start joining together all these different groups that have been compartmentalized in the past and all joining forces together to fight the same system.
Uh-huh. And a word that I was using earlier before we all started talking is climate justice. So could does anybody here want to just talk about what that means, climate justice, or how that works with all of this?
Yeah, so climate justice is twofold. It's one, a recognition of the injustices in the problem of climate change. Historically, predominantly wealthy white people have emitted the most carbon emissions in the United States, Europe, and Australia. And these same people are the most able to adapt to the climate crisis and not feel the impacts, whereas people who are poor or living in the global south are feeling the brunt of these problems and do not have the same support networks and infrastructure, in a large part due to wealth inequality, to survive and really bear through the impacts of climate change. Climate justice also recognizes the fact that because climate change is such a big problem and necessitates widespread social change, it's an opportunity to really address economic and racial injustice in our society and build a world that is truly based on equality for everyone.
Hi, I'm hoping people heard that. There seems to be some glitches going on here, but we might have to have you re-speak all that. But anyway, so basically what we're saying is that the people who are the most affected by climate change are also most affected by all the different things that are going on with the system that we're dealing with right now. And what are those? Like capitalism comes up. And what are these root causes just specifically? Maybe, Jamie, would you like to say? Or?
Sure. The system which is tearing the planet apart by constant growth, that's the capitalist system, which is based on constant growth, is also exploiting and oppressing workers and people throughout the world and society. And our orientation in 15 now is that we want to build worker power and use the weapons that workers have, particularly the strike weapon, to push back, to shut down, to disrupt this capitalist system. And we've seen this amazing strike wave with the Fight for 15 across the country, starting with the fast food workers three years ago. It's the most exciting thing that's been happening with workers and worker power in this country for a while. And to somehow figure out how to intersect the climate justice movement with worker power is what's really needed to change, to really turn things around.
And just to bring more into this, white supremacy is apparently, that's big on the rising tide list of what's going on. And Don't Shoot Portland, you're perfect for talking about that. How does that tie in for you? And Alyssa Pagan.
Thank you very much. One of the things that I look forward to with participating in Rising Tide is their emphasis on direct action, having action councils where people can come and request support bodies in the street. The Black Lives Matter movement has a national call for shutting it down, disrupting business as usual. And oftentimes, in order to be able to do that successfully, we need many, many people to be at actions. And being able to tap into a rising tide, many of the people who are involved are actively working to extend their hand for people fighting for racial justice and to help to heal the narrative that people that fight for the environment don't care about Black struggle. And that is something that many people in the movement and people looking on think about, people who are interested in combating climate change. And I'm really appreciative for Rising Tide and Flood the System, because they are really being intentional about reaching out across those lines. Something that many of us know is that racism is actually in the air you breathe, that in poor neighborhoods that are mostly Black and Latino, they bear the brunt of a lot of the emissions. I come from New Jersey, in case you couldn't tell already by my accent, where the port of Newark is one of the most busy ports on the East Coast. And the diesel trucks that pick up the shipments that go out throughout the tri-state area often take the trucks that diesel engines that are past a certain age are not allowed to pick up at other ports. But because the Port of Newark still allows for it, they get a lot of the castaways, so that the trucks that have more clean fuels, they go to other ports. And as a result, an extreme amount of children in the Newark area that those trucks pass through have asthma. Mm-hmm. And kids that can afford not to live, or kids and parents, families who can afford to not live in Newark, in that area where the fumes are going up and they have to breathe them in, well they can escape. They can leave. And what about justice for the people that have to breathe that in, that right. can only afford to live there? Right. And this is reoccurring throughout the country and throughout the world. People who can't afford to breathe clean air.
And then, of course, if it was just all renewables, the air would just automatically be clean. But one of the things I was listening to Naomi Klein yesterday, and she was talking about how the whole system is kind of set up right now where the Koch brothers, for instance, are giving $1 billion to the election. And that, like $1 billion, that's kind of unprecedented. And they do have it kind of figured out that somehow renewable energy is connected to the labor issues, that it is connected to even like gun control, that as Naomi was saying, that we need an unprecedented collaboration to make this, to change things. And the people who are fighting this do not want us to collaborate. What I'd like to say is that it sounds like you guys are sort of figuring out that collaboration is really the only way through this. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Yes. Very true.
Okay. So anyway, and then Ibrahim. Yeah. Sorry, I wanted to ask you a little more, just in terms of the whole homeless thing, how that kind of ties in to. And it sort of goes with what Alyssa was saying, that poor people, they're more likely to end up with asthma and things like that. But how are homeless people impacted by the changing weather and the changing climate and things like that are going on?
Well, you know that people have certain rights, and we have to figure out what's more important, corporate rights or human rights. And the corporations are the ones that's polluting this country and destroying this country because of greed and the wealthy. And when they do that, they force poverty and homelessness, because when you gentrify a neighborhood in the name of progression, that you're leaving people out. And where are they going? Or where are you putting the people when you gentrify and you moving them to certain areas, like you do cattle, or like you did the original people of this country? Are you shipping them out to toxic land with toxic water and stuff?
Newark, as we were saying.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what's happening in the houseless community, where people who are not looked at as humans are being shoved out to the edge of the city and of the states. And that's why we joined the Superfund thing, PAC, Portland Harbor Community Coalition, where we're trying to help the EPA clean up the Willamette Cove and the Columbia Gorge, where houseless people are sleeping, and that water is toxic. And if that water is toxic, that soil is toxic. And if that soil is toxic, the vegetables they're growing is toxic, so they're eating toxic vegetables
right.
and stuff. Or people that's sleeping under the bridges, that's inhaling all the fumes and stuff, where they're going. And as we were talking about before, in this heat, people saying, stay inside, get on your air conditioner. Where are the houseless people going?
Right, the homeless people have no place to go at all.
What water are they drinking? And then if they do eat, and if they do drink in the water, they have to exercise their human rights, which is God-given. They have to get rid of that waste. So by not having public restroom, they being forced to make this city or this state
even more toxic
because they got to get rid of their waste, and they got to get rid of somewhere. And so people are looking at the homeless community saying, look at them, they pooping and everything in the streets, but they have nowhere to go.
Right.
So they kind of like being forced to destroy the environment. And that's where we want to come in and say, well, we kind of environmentalists because we live in an environment, we breathe in the air, we eat in the food, we live in on the land, we drink in this water. But what's happening is that they've taken our rights from us. And so that's where we can connect the dots with Portland Rising and Flood the System, where we all need to come together and explain the certain things that we that's blind to people that don't know about houselessness.
Right. Well, I just want to let listeners know you're tuned to the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with a lot of activists here who are all affiliated with different systems and different groups here in Portland, joining forces with the organization Rising Tide, Portland Rising Tide to Flood the System. Now, this was all supposed to start happening in September, Flood the System. Maybe you could explain a little more about how it's going to actually work.
Well, Flood the System, more than anything to me, is an organizing strategy. So at this point, we are convening different groups. We're talking about where we all want to go together, so that we're trying really hard not to have the perspective of, you know, we are the environmentally focused people and everybody should come work with us. But, you know, we want to know what everybody cares about so that we can really grow this as a cohesive movement.
It's sort of like a, would you say it's a kind of outgrowth of Occupy in a way? I mean, just in terms of...
Sort of. I mean, there's definitely some influence there. But the way Flood the System is supposed to work, it's centered around the idea of the Action Council. So it's more or less a system of organizing ourselves that is scalable, that we can work up so that we can have many, many groups hopefully involved who can work together, join forces, put together massive direct actions as opposed to the one-off piecemeal things that we're doing now. So the goal is to build towards that, and we realize that that will take some time. So we're just in the starting phase right now and hoping to continue to grow that in the future.
So you feel like you're starting out. And yes. And how does it feel for you guys to be part of this process? Maybe just one or two of you could tell me. Like, when you go to the meeting, for instance, Jamie, do you feel very included and inclusive, or are there sort of more of struggles and fightings trying to coordinate how this is all going to work? Or,
well, we're organizations that have worked together and not worked together in the past, but I think that there's a recognition that there's hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and disrupting business as usual over the last few years. And, you know, whether it was the Occupy movement or the Black Lives Matter movement or the Fight for 15 or the climate justice action or the immigrant rights, that if we can combine forces, you know, if we're marching separately but we strike together at the same enemy, we'll have a much bigger impact. And if we say, you know, you take one of us on, you take all of us on, the powers that be will have to respond in a way that they haven't.
So you wouldn't have, like, at a Don't Shoot Portland rally, you wouldn't have a bunch of 15 Now people, but there'd be a sense that they had your back somehow anyway, or?
Well, actually, that's happening.
Don't Shoot Portland is already very involved with 15 Now, and 15 Now is already very involved with Don't Shoot Portland and with all Black Lives Matter groups across the country.
I'm getting a chill.
And you should. Because something that we often say is that it is much more difficult to occupy neighborhoods and oppress people if they're not living in abject poverty. That 15 Now will mean lifting the wages of many of the people right. that live in poor neighborhoods, and that one of the reasons that police are so easy or so effective at being able to pick people off and put them through the prison system is because...
Or even shoot them.
Thank you. Hands up, don't shoot. Right. So if these people actually have access to living wages, well, then it's that much more difficult to be able to oppress them because they're not living in the kind of desperation that they are now with the low wages that we have to endure as minimum wage.
We do have a caller. Is he still there, Eric? Eric, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, I have a question. It's great to have all your thought leaders here gathered today. And the question I have is the root cause, pretty much for all the problems for everybody in the room was, nobody was really allowed to think or discuss the paradigm shift that pretty much started all these problems. And that's basically 9/11. The scientific evidence of 9/11. And if you can't discuss that, then you pretty much can't, all the problems of today can't never be resolved, and there'll be more problems to come about.
Okay, so Eric's saying that 9/11 somehow is one of the root causes, and does anybody have a comment on that?
I got a comment, but you may not like it. So.
Oh, go for it. What is it, Ibrahim?
I think it was a country crying out to the American public, if they did it, saying this is what your country is doing to us, and that's the only way they can get our attention back. However, I think that was concocted by the American government so they can go over there and seize land so they can take over their resources.
But there's
stuff.
A lot of suspicion
right,
around
it,
definitely.
It's all kind of suspicion. But yeah. But right now, that 9/11, it happened. We recuperating from it. We have to address the problems and the issues that's affecting the people, this city, this country now. That happened already.
And again, it was about fossil fuels. It was about, and what, did you have some comment, Mia?
Yeah, I just thought 9/11 was used to justify the United States military expanding its presence in the Middle East. Yeah. And the U.S. military is actually one of the world's largest greenhouse gas emitters. It's not required to report its emissions, but it's estimated that 5% of global emissions are from the U.S. military alone. And that's the equivalent of many, many countries around the world. And in order to address climate change and all the issues we are facing, talking about around this table, we have to address militarism, we have to curb back the military, we have to demilitarize the police. These are critical issues.
So Mason, what do you have to say on that one?
At Portland State University, they just the Board of Trustees just made the decision to militarize our police, even though there was a lot of pushback from the PSU Student Union. So there was this student
Get close.
Okay, sorry. There was the student voice that was very present that was saying, we do not want our campus security to be militarized. And there was also the staff voice. There was the faculty voice. There was community members, but they still went through with it. And so that definitely ties into the university system and how it's very diminishing towards everyone who's not administration.
Right. And also, I just realized I didn't ask you how USP, it's a University of Portland State University Student Union, right?
That's yes.
Your organization.
Yeah.
And so they're addressing a lot of stuff around right now, this, as you say, the militarization of the security at Portland State. But also, I saw on your agenda, there was a lot of stuff about just education's dropping in terms of like less faculty, less support for students. Student costs are going up. The administration is getting more top heavy. This is a lot of stuff that you're talking about, like education isn't working for people right now. Mm-hmm. And how are you guys trying to work on that? And how does that kind of intersect with climate justice? Or can you sort of make a connection there?
Yes. So the PSU Student Union, we're working very closely with other student groups, so definitely building the student voice, but also working with faculty and staff, and also like tying into 15 Now. We're very supportive of the Don't Shoot Black Lives Matter movement, and trying to really restructure how university systems work, because they're not sustainable, they're not helpful towards students at all. And so that's and tying into tying into the climate justice movement. So we, a lot of us from the PSU Student Union heard about Flood the System and very interested in it because it's very intersectional, very intentional. And we all live in this environment and we have to really fight for it. And like, there's a lot of bad stuff happening that we're really trying to combat, especially being intersectional, because if it's not intersectional, it's not going to really help anyone.
Yeah, I want to get more into intersectional and also divestment, but we have another caller. Yeah. Kevin, what would you like to ask us?
Oh, hi. I just had a comment. I don't know if people know about Charlie Hale's new street high-intensity street engagement program. I'm with the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association. One of the things that we're for is freedom of choice when it comes to psychiatric medication and treatment. We see an awful lot of people rounded up and medicalized because they're homeless or they're in poverty. And that's a big issue for us, that we don't think people should be forcibly drugged against their wills or should be medicalized as mentally ill just because they're in poverty or homeless. Uh-huh. And I want to make sure that continues to be, you know, an active part of the agenda for activists in Portland. I'll take your responses off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
That is something that Right to Survive, Right to Dream 2 is working on, because we noticed that when they shut down all the mental health institutions, that a lot of people flooded the streets of Portland, and even other cities have sent their people here. Also, that when people do first become houseless, they have that choice on how to survive in the streets, and sometimes they self-medicate, or when the police are sweeping them, they take the prescription drugs from the houseless community, and they have no other means of calming themselves down or curing themselves. And that's why when you see people in the streets, you don't know, you think that they are irate or something, but it's because they're being forced to be on pharmaceutical drugs, which is a mean of control, and that's what capitalism do. They want to control you, they want to dictate to you, they want to put you in certain geographical areas and stuff. So I usually tell the social worker, if you can't tell the difference between a person that's been sleep deprived or have mental issues or coming down off a drug, you're not a good social worker. And that's what we have to recognize, that people that's been sleep deprived do develop mental issues.
Right.
People that used to being inside and all of a sudden they don't educate people how to live in the street do develop mental issues. But that's not the thing, is to put them on pharmaceutical drug. It's to teach them and educate them on how to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think pharmaceutical drug is one of the biggest money makers here in this country, besides the military, and then, pardon me, the educational system.
It's another part of the whole corporate, yeah. You know, our basically the whole corporate, Citizens United, and how the corporate takeover of the whole political system is another issue, but, you know, you guys are going to change all this.
Hopefully.
We, not you.
Yes, I'm part of
we,
it.
We, yeah.
And finally, I want to get back to the students thing and divestment. How are you guys thinking about that, or planning on working on any of that? Or
yeah, we have been, this past year, we worked really closely with Divest PSU. We turned out to what they were, their actions and stuff. They've actually been doing fairly well, I guess, compared to other universities,
right,
that don't
college.
Get
yeah not happening
yeah.
Can we explain what divest means?
Yeah, let's talk about that. In fact, Jamie, you want to say?
I mean, we're talking about PSU. Right?
Okay, go for it, Mason.
Someone might have to fill in blanks for me, but I can start it off. So divesting from fossil fuels.
It means pulling the university money out of those companies that are involved in extraction and distribution of fossil fuels.
Right.
And the other college divest movement that is starting to take off in the U.S. too is private prison divest. I think it was Columbia University just divested, which is a huge, huge win. The private prison industry is terrible. That is one of the worst things happening in our country right now. And to connect that with fossil fuel divest, I think, is really important, and to recognize how it is. It's corporatism. It's the privatization of life and of people and of our natural systems that are really driving these problems.
Yeah, it definitely connects. And I think that the prison industry itself is just, like I was reading, again, back to the climate with this, that someone's told me $2 an hour, but I read somewhere else that it was $26 a day is all these prison firefighters are getting. And they're sending a lot of prisoners into the forest fires to fight the fires that are being fueled, of course, by climate change.
Prisoners are being put on the front lines of the climate crisis, being the ones out there who are, you know, they don't have a lot of agency in that, getting paid $1 a day, $2 an hour, depending on where they are, shoveling snow and blizzards that are extra bad because of climate change, fighting fires that are extra bad because of climate change. And California governor actually came out last week talking about how the state of California is going to lose a lot of money if they let some of these prisoners out who have been fighting fires, because they count on the cheap labor of prisoners to address the wildfires. And that is a huge problem. We cannot be reliant on prisoners to address climate change.
And another thing about prisoners is they're predominantly people of color. And so, again, it's like a sort of a weird way we've got slavery back into our system again.
High tech.
Yeah. Anyway, I want to let listeners know again, you're tuned to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with activists from these different groups who are working with Portland Rising Tide to get at the roots of climate change and economic and social injustice. The groups that are here with me right now include Don't Shoot Portland, 15 Now, Portland State University Union, Right to Dream To, Right to Survive, and 350 PDX, and of course, Rising Tide. It's a very packed studio in this moment, but it's sort of very inspiring. And I'd like to talk a little bit more again about intersectionality. Can a few of you maybe just discuss exactly what intersectionality really is and how that is really at the core of what you're trying to do?
When I was on the planning committee for the U.S. Social Forum, we came across intersectionality, and that to me that means that everybody everybody came together, they created mass mobilization, but then people had their own podium. So intersectionality is saying how each case or each podium are coming together and we have some commonality with one another. I was in Detroit for the water rights against Marathon, and in a city where they are cutting people water off and forcing them to become homeless. And this one lady, she wouldn't do it, and she started to boil some water, and her stove exploded because the gas from Marathon was leaking into the water system.
Now, wait, Marathon gas leaking into water?
Yeah, down in Lansing, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And so doing that, it's messing with the environment. They want more land again. Which is better, corporate rights or human rights? And corporate rights are superseding human rights, and then doing this is forcing change in the environment. You know, we paying for water now, we paying to live on land. Next thing we do, are we going to be paying to breathe the air?
Right.
I think a great local example of an issue with a lot of intersectionality is gentrification, because a lot of the development that's going on in Portland right now is being done in the name of addressing climate change. We're being told that, you know, we need to live in more dense housing, that it's more energy efficient, that we need to live in denser communities so that we can drive less, walk more, bike more. And that's all true. But those new housing options are really only available to people who can pay for them.
And they're expensive, like $2,000 a month for a one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. So we have supposed solutions to climate change that are only available to people with higher income, that are displacing longtime communities, that are really affecting lower-income people. So it ties in poverty and homelessness and discrimination, and so many of these issues all kind of come together in that one problem.
Right. In other words, it's taking a good idea and twisting it somehow.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I also want to talk to the listeners, just in case some of them have not heard of the term intersectionality.
Right.
And
does it mean?
It comes from a repudiation of the idea that uniformity is unity, that in order for people to be able to attach themselves to a movement means that they cannot bring their own identities to the table as a way to enrich it, that somehow detracts from whatever the movement of the day is. And I want to encourage your readers to read Bell Hooks, who is one of the people that helped to form our ideas about what intersectionality is. And it means that all things have to be all things all the time. That when typically, like what Bell Hooks writes about is that feminism cannot be white feminism, cannot be heterosexual feminism, cannot be cis, meaning not trans feminism, that it has to do a good job of being all things all the time for everyone, or else it really is not doing the job that it set out to do in the first place. And all it does is reproduce the problematic systems of which they claim to be acting against. So in terms of climate justice, in terms of flood the system, with them being so intentional about their intersectional approach, it means that we are not only calling on people who are adamant about protecting the environment. And yes, we do want people to be aware about the degradation of our environment, the complete destruction of our environment in the name of capitalism, in the name of profit, but that they are actually able to take steps to be very intentional about including elements of racial justice, economic justice, issues around gender, sexuality, ability, that with that approach, knowing that we value all of these things so much that we are going to actually be showing up to all of these actions of all of these people through the Action Council as a way to put forth that good faith.
And so basically, everybody matters. I see this in a way as like just how nature itself works, you know, like a gladiola plant and a redwood tree. I mean, all of this is part of what makes the world work. And you're saying this is also part of what makes a human society work. All of our differences, it sounds like.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. We have Anne on the phone, I think. Is it Anne? Are you still
Hello?
There? Hi, Anne.
Yes, I'm there.
Yeah. What would you like to say or comment or ask or what?
I have one question. Why is not the tool of boycott being used?
Okay, one question, the tool of boycott. Why is that not being used, or is it being used?
One thing that Flood the System is embracing is an approach that utilizes different tactics when strategically appropriate. And so boycott could be a tool being used. I think that boycotts, one way I see boycotts being used right now that I think is really great is with the BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement happening right now that is addressing Israeli apartheid and the need for Palestinian sovereignty and human rights and dignity for all. And so we are very aware of that. There is a group in Portland called Super that is working on Palestinian rights, and I encourage everyone to familiarize themselves with that issue if they are not already.
Right. And boycotts could be happening with anything. I mean, I'm sort of like wishing that someday we could all just boycott using our cars and buying gasoline at all, you know, that kind of thing, or boycotting factory animal food, or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways, but in a way, it seems to me, boycotts can be a mass action, but they kind of rely on individuals, and it sounds like you guys want to have bodies in places. Is that what I'm sort of hearing?
Yes, yes. Absolutely, and people mass need to be together in the street, whether it's shutting down a bridge or a city hall or a police station, to feel their collective power, to gain the confidence that's necessary and the trust of working together in struggle, to be able to move enough people power to actually change the system. And boycotts don't have that same kind of they don't.
Excitement.
They don't produce. Well, they just don't produce the kind of result that we need, which is people more willing to take risks, to shut stuff down, and sacrifice. You know, like strikes and like occupations, like flooding the system.
Right. Well. There was a strike recently in Germany where I think 1,000 people just sat down at a coal mine. Do you guys know about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is that the kind of thing you'd like to see here?
That is exactly the kind of thing that we would like to see happen here. 1,500 people in Germany occupied the largest coal mine in Europe and the largest greenhouse gas emitter, and in what is a truly beautiful action. And one thing that is so powerful about these mass mobilizations as well is that they bring people together and they force people to have conversations with people and to start to build those relationships. And we really need to be working on that and doing that deep community building right now. I think especially with climate change, we do have some time left to address the problem, but it is a finite time window until catastrophic climate change will happen. And we are going to need these relationships and this community building in order to survive through the changes that we are going to experience in the coming decades.
Right, because actually that is part of it. I mean, we're going to change, but just what's already in place in terms of climate change is going to create a lot of suffering. I mean, they don't even know if they can hold it at 2 degrees, the increase in the temperature, and that's 2 degrees Celsius, which translates to something like 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And yeah, do you have a comment on
that? Yeah, well, just, you know, one thing that people don't talk about as much is the warming that's already happened. Oregon has already warmed 3 degrees Fahrenheit since the 1970s, and that's even more so the case in Portland, where we also have the urban heat island effect. And so we're already living in the years of living dangerously, and times are bad. A lot is happening. Half the sockeye salmon run died this year because water was too hot. We're experiencing unprecedented wildfires and air pollution around that, severe winter storms like we haven't seen in a long time. And we need community, and we need relationships, and we need a community that is going to treat every person, regardless of their class status, regardless of the color of their skin, the language they speak, where they were born, as equals and as the same, with dignity and respect for everyone.
It's beautiful. And there's a book, a little booklet that Rising Tide has put out that people can download it. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about that a little bit, Katie.
Well, the booklet kind of lays out the organizing strategy behind Flood the System. It talks about, you know, how these different struggles are interconnected, how capitalism is really the root cause of so many of these problems. And it lays out, like I said, a strategy for us getting together and movement building in an anti-oppressive and inclusive way. So there's some information in there on anti-oppression work and how we can organize spaces that are safe spaces for lots of different people, so that we can try not to replicate the same oppressive systems of sexism, patriarchy, racism that we have currently in our society. So a big part of Flood the System is making sure that this movement that we are trying to build is not replicating those same patterns and is leading a path forward that, you know, it is what we should do in the future, is how we should relate to one another in an anti-oppressive
and
way.
And I sort of recall that, let me see, there was like direct actions, and then there was more like floods, or it has these sort of interesting ways of sort of describing all with water symbolism.
There is a big water metaphor.
Yeah.
From like the knowledge that comes down in the rain and collects in the puddles, and then we like take that, and I don't know the whole metaphor, but
you have, and then there was also this idea that you have times when you're active and then times when you kind of pull back and kind of suss out how this actually went, and, you know, kind of maybe even lick a few wounds, but then you're ready to go back again. And a
it's
lot
true.
Of sort of,
well,
yeah.
That's it's really easy when we are building this momentum and building up towards big actions. Afterwards, everybody's burnt out and tired and has to regroup, and it can feel like a downer. But we need to realize that this is part of the process,
the
that
process.
We need to put a bunch of energy into movement building and direct action, and then take some time for ourselves to regroup, maybe like figure out next steps before we go out there again, because it's a lot of work and it's exhausting work.
Yeah.
And we also need to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves.
We do have another caller. What's your name? Mimi, what would you like to say or ask?
Hi. I wanted to, first of all, thank you guys for doing all of the hard work you do. I participated in some of the actions recently and am grateful to you. What I would like to bring attention to, as well as other actions, is the nuclear power plant that we have in Washington State, and it's not Hanford. That's its own issue. It's the Columbia Generating Station. And that's something that I work on with very few people. And I've been trying to talk with Rising Tide and other folks to get involved with me, or my ability to get involved with you, to really look into what's happening there. One of the main issues that is happening regarding what you're talking about today is that the river is warming up, the Columbia. The Columbia is the same water that is supposed to cool down this nuclear power plant. That's where they get the water from. As that water heats up, it's not going to be able to cool down the plant. And the plant owners, Energy Northwest, they don't care. So I want to just bring that to the forefront to say, can you start to adapt and include nuclear issues with what we're doing in Cascadia? And that's basically it. And I'd love to listen, if you don't need to ask me anything, just off air.
Okay. Any thoughts on that? Like, the caller wants to know if we can include nuclear issues in the whole Rising Tide.
Yeah. So Rising Tide put out a great zine a few years back called Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, and it is all about solutions and false solutions to climate change. Rising Tide, as an organization, believes that nuclear power is a false solution to climate change for many different reasons, ranging from nuclear waste to privatization and ownership of our energy system. And we're really pushing for energy democracy and a decentralized energy system that is owned by the people for the people, that helps communities build wealth and reclaim their power back from private companies.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And basically, I want to let, again, listeners know, you're tuned to the Recovery Zone here on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with activists affiliated with different groups here in Portland who have joined forces with Rising Tide to flood the system. We have Alyssa Pagan, Ibrahim Mubarak, Mia Reback, Jamie Partridge, Katie Berendt, and Mason, what's your last name?
Ashwell.
Mason Ashwell. Right. And so have you guys started to come up already now with actions that you sort of see that will be happening? Because this is all supposed to start happening in September, right? And through November. And actually, I read that it's basically a kind of a lead up to the talks that will be happening in Paris to... could you maybe just talk about what that means exactly?
Well, the talks that are happening in Paris in December, I think are the 21st year that this group is convening. And for 21 years, they've been meeting, and they have not been seriously addressing the
problem.
And
we're saying that's because of the system that's trying to make these talks work.
It's because these people are beholden to the system. They are there to try to find ways to sort of address the problem and pacify people while maintaining capitalism and their positions of power. Uh-huh. So we do not expect...
So you're saying that can't work.
No. We do not expect any solutions to come out because, again, they've done this 20 times before and there have not been solutions. So we're trying to use that as an opportunity to call attention to real solutions and the real root causes of these problems and point out that they are not going to fix this for us.
So, and yeah, basically, the solutions are not going to come from a system that's so dysfunctional.
No.
Yeah. And but what kinds of actions are you, or can you even say, or are there going to be surprises that are going to be sprung on the public later?
Or I would like ours to be a surprise.
Okay, Ibrahim. Well,
we can say that they will be mass and participatory, and that the actual the process of acting together will not only disrupt the system but will change the people involved. And when we talk about intersectionality, we want to bring together all these different movements so that people can interact with each other and learn to you know, have confidence and trust in each other. And yeah, that as much as anything is the importance of what we're doing.
Uh-huh. So basically, if you wanted to find out what's happening, it's to go to a Rising Tide meeting, it sounds like, or to join some of the groups that are part of Rising Tide and then get involved in it that way, it sounds like.
If you look at history, you look at the poor people in the French Revolution, they rose up and took over, and I guess took over the government and made it comfortable for them. You look at the recent rise up in Egypt on how they did things. So the American government is you know, it's the preamble started off, we the people, not we the rich or we the 1% or we the corporate. So the people have to get together, and that's where this intersectionality is coming to par, and that's where it's going to be real. We the people can take over, back over this country, back over the land. I don't mean they have all the nuclear weapons and bombs, but we can start educating our children right now to be politicians, to fight for this cause and stuff like that. But we need to come together as a whole and not as individual. And as she said, a boycott. No, we need to fight and demand and take what's rightfully ours, and that's our country.
And then what about politics itself? Like, Mia, you actually gave an introduction speech to the Bernie Sanders thing. Are there some politicians that we feel we could maybe, that could help us with this?
Our political system is designed in a way where elected officials actually have very little power to create change. So even those with the best of intentions are limited in what they can do. And I think we saw that, you know, with Barack Obama getting elected, where he really ran on a platform of hope and change. But once he got into office, he was deeply constrained by Congress, by the Judicial Department, by, you know, others in his executive system.
Cut off at the knees almost.
Yeah, and so, you know, we really can't solely rely on politicians to solve our problems. I believe that individuals and communities need to empower themselves, and through collective action, I believe we can do this, to really bring about the changes that we want to see for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And is this something else the rest of you agree with? It's okay. We'll move on. How about you, Jamie?
Well, yes, totally agree that the government doesn't move except through movement pressure.
It needs to be
movements
pushed.
Move the government. And one of the things that that we believe in 15 now is that organizing workers to move and fight and strike and is going to move government, as well as We're taking the $15 minimum wage to the ballot, which means that the people are going to have to make this happen through, you know, signing petitions and voting. That we're not going to get our $15 minimum wage from the politicians.
Right. Or actually, again, the Koch brothers, Alec, what was it, the American Legislative Exchange Council that they fund, is pushing against this in a way. I what was I reading that they're trying to. I guess there's a bunch of states, including Oregon, where cities can't choose the $15 minimum wage just for themselves. They have to go with the prevailing state, and Alec is pushing that kind of thing because, again, they figure out that they don't want organized labor. They don't want labor that can get decent wages. It just doesn't work for their profit system. So you guys are, when you push through the state, that's kind of what you're going to be trying to change?
Oh, certainly. That's one of the things.
Yeah.
But currently we've got a $15 minimum wage ballot initiative for the state of Oregon.
For the whole state of Oregon.
Yeah.
Right. So that would just deflect the whole preempt thing. Okay. Anyway, moving on. So I'd kind of like to get a sense then of what this world then is going to be like. Like you were talking about, for instance, energy systems that are just kind of distributed everywhere. I sort of, instead of a chicken in every pot, it's a solar panel on every roof kind of thing, right? And how do you guys see our world if climate justice actually does prevail? What kind of visions?
Well, one of the things that a lot of people seem to agree we're going to have to do is what's called relocalizing.
Relocalizing.
You look at how much oil we burn to transport goods halfway around the world. You know, we make everything in China. We ship it over here on giant cargo ships. We don't really make much here. Uh-huh. And we need to start doing that again, because we need to, in limiting emissions and limiting the amount of energy we use, one of the easiest ways to do that is to have as much local activity as we can, so we're not shipping things necessarily halfway around the world. It's also a great way to address community resilience and to have like communities that are making things and supporting themselves, and we have jobs and we have like suddenly a healthy local economy that everybody can participate in. So it's like, for me at least, I see a lot of this relocalizing and bringing the economy back to the local.
And this is part of just transitions, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah. And could you maybe say a little bit more about just transitions, or how that actually looks then? It's relocalizing, and are there other parts to that? In other words, is just transitions only relocalizing, or is it really changing consciousness in a way?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. So the idea behind a just transition is that because of climate change, there is so much we have to do, and we have to make sure that we're doing it in a way that is fair and equitable for everyone. and that we make sure that in addressing climate change, those that were benefiting from our previous system aren't unfairly benefiting from the new system that we are creating, and that those who have been historically disenfranchised or left out are the leaders, and that their voices are elevated. And so within a just transition, it means housing for everyone. It means a good job with dignity and fair pay for everyone. It means an end to racial profiling and an end to racism throughout our system. And it really is connected to a value shift and switching to a system that values life, be it plant and animal life and human life, and really truly values life and respects people and values people over stuff. And so we're consuming things that have meaning and benefit to us, and we're not consuming things because our society tells us that's how we'll be happy, and that we really will get happiness from human connections and from enrichment and social power.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing. And how about you?
I understand that many people are so used to being completely dominated by corporations, and particularly in the realm of energy, that the idea that workers could be controlling that mean of production,
cooperatives,
which is socialism, which, by the way, is not something that Bernie Sanders is advocating for in his platform. So we absolutely do have the capacity to do it. Everyday people, we all have the ability to be able to transform our society and to be able to take hold of it ourselves. That just because we live in a society now where corporations run our everyday lives and control the way that we get energy and the way that it's distributed and the way that it's priced, it does not have to be this way. And we absolutely have the capacity to do it.
And it does. I mean, you do see these little steps being taken. I think people are, for one thing, the price of renewables is really dropping, which is a very good sign. And it's starting to be where using coal plants is less effective or less efficient and more cost, you know, whatever. So coal is actually a kind of a dying thing right now because renewables are taking the place of it. And I mean, you can see that if we can really goose this along, that it could even go farther and farther and farther. But it's a lot. And one last thought I had, this goes back to what you just said about animals. And I do have kind of a issue with myself with factory farms. I really feel like it's a very cruel, number one, cruel way of getting our food. And at the same time, it also pushes a lot of, I guess the nitrous oxide is like 200 times what a CO2 carbon does to, and all of these things are like, and we use a lot of nitrous oxides with our pesticides and stuff. So is there in Rising Tide a group or anything connected to more animal rights and changing that whole, the way we do our food and blah, blah?
Yeah, so a lot of people in Rising Tide are very opposed to factory farms for good reason. And, you know, speaking of intersectionality, factory farms are a great example of that, where extreme social injustice is taking place at factory farms, very unsafe working conditions, right, exposed to a lot of hazards. And there are even cases where that we know about where factory farms are running solely on labor of undocumented people, but have deals worked out with immigration so they don't deport everyone at the same time, so they can keep this constant stream of cheap labor coming in to their factory farms where they don't have to be accountable to their workers. And so I think that addressing factory farms is very, very important when we talk about a just transition.
Great.
Even with Right to Survive, Right to Dream, we're in solidarity with food sovereignty. Great. And it's a group in Bellingham, Washington called Community, where they're undocumented people. They're growing their own vegetables and stuff. And some of them can't even eat because they can't afford the vegetables that they're growing. And they won't eat because of the pesticide.
And again,
and again with the food, how they send them down to a factory, and the animals or the chickens, they see each other being slaughtered. Like KFC is growing chicken on a stick and stuff like that.
Yeah,
that's
crazy.
Why you see a lot of people walking around looking like they're in shock, but it's because the food they eating is in shock, so they look like the food they eat.
But we're running out of time, and that's a great last comment. But I just want to let people know, how can you get in touch with Rising Tide? It's just, what's the website? Quick.
It's Portland Rising Tide.
PortlandRisingTide.org.
Mm-hmm. And I also encourage people to check out the Flood the System website, which is floodthesystem.net. And there's a lot of great information up there.
Okay.
And all of the groups here all have Facebook pages, and I encourage everyone to really look up and like all the pages of all of these groups to stay up to date on our activities.
Okay, so just want to let listeners know, this has been, you've been hearing from activists who are involved with different groups who are linking up with each other to change the system, flood the system. And these have been Alyssa Pagan, who is with Don't Shoot Portland PDX, 15 Now, Jamie Partridge, PSU Student Union, Mason, your last name?
Ashley.
Ashley, yeah. And then we've also got Karen Berent from Rising Tide. Katie Berent from Rising Tide. And Mia Reback from 350 PDX. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I want to thank Tammy for her engineering. And thank you for listening and supporting listener-supported community radio.
Now, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's. It's a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th, right down the street from KBOO. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. And that's it for public affairs programming here on KBOO this morning. We're going to get right to the KBOO Noon News, and then Nick is here with Jazz Lives.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, August 26, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson.
In local news, state economists announced the latest revenue forecast today. All indications are that taxpayers can count on a refund of part of their 2014 taxes. However, the state's legislative revenue officer has indicated it will probably be smaller than estimated in May.
A survey of the undergraduate women at the University of Oregon, released Monday, indicates 27% have experienced at least one non-consensual sexual incident, rape, sexual assault, or some form of sexual victimization.